This is an ABC podcast.
When Anna Sale was having a post-baby checkup, the male gynecologist she'd just met wanted to talk to her about tips for physical intimacy after giving birth. Oh, God, thought Anna, I want this to be over. But she forced herself to meet his eye and engage in the respectful but direct conversation he was offering. Anna Sale has made a commitment to these kinds of uncomfortable conversations. She's the creator and host of a podcast called Death, Sex and Money. And in the show, she talks to people about exactly the topics we often try to avoid. Every individual, every family, every culture has taboo topics. Subjects that aren't really talked about, even if they are really important. Often, they're the most important ones. But as I know, asking strangers to honestly share their stories is one thing. Having these conversations with people we actually know and have relationships with, that can be much trickier. Anna wanted to find out how to have more honest communication in her own life, and so she's written a book about it. It's called Let's Talk About Hard Things, Death, Sex, Money, and Other Difficult Conversations. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Anna, as interviewers, you and I, we talk about hard things with strangers all the time. Why is that harder to do with people we know and love?
Oh, because the stakes are different. If you mess up, it matters in a whole other way. And also, we are invested in a deeper way in our own lives than we are when we're talking with strangers. I find it much easier to lean into my curiosity and deep listening with strangers than it is with people in my life, where something they say might make me feel defensive, might make me feel misunderstood, might make me feel that I need to battle for what is the right version of facts. And that's not something that happens when I'm talking to people who I'm not in relationship with in my personal life. But I think what's interesting is like the practice and the skills of listening with real curiosity that I think I've honed through my years in journalism have helped me be a better listener and someone who is able to sit in uncomfortable conversations with people I love.
What kind of subjects were taboo in your family when you were growing up?
You know, in my family, I come from a family where my dad was a doctor and my mom was a physical therapist. So on the one hand, like matters of the body were sort of like talked about at the dinner table and, you know, in that kind of way where, you know, the fact of traumatic injuries. My dad was an orthopedist, so many of his patients were well one day and then broken the next, literally their bones broken. So that sense of perilousness that can come, you know, was very real in growing up. And I had very clinical but direct conversations about sex as I was coming of age within my family. Not a lot of talk about like pleasure or, you know, orgasms or that sort of thing.
Here are a list of diseases that you are eligible for.
Exactly. And, you know, so, and then in the way we talked about money, there was a lot that was left out. You know, in my family, something that was just a mantra was, you know, you need to appreciate how fortunate your family is. So a real sense of like, there is difference when it comes to the amount of money that people have in the world, and you are on the lucky side of that. And so I was quite aware of that growing up, but I had no idea like what that meant. I think I still don't really know how much money my parents have. Like, that was not something we talked directly about. And, you know, we didn't really talk directly about trade-offs when it came to money. Like, I can remember when I finished college, I was a history major, and I was sort of like, what am I going to do with my life? And I had been sort of raised in that generation of, like, find your passion, you know, and then it was like, yes, I have found a passion, and I also recognize that my passion pays a lot less than what my, you know, friends who went to work for Google after graduation are making, you know, which is fine, but it's like, oh, money is a real thing, you know, there are consequences to the choices you make about what you do with your time and where you spend your energy.
Yeah, passion and profit can diverge in startling ways. Tell me about the sort of conversations you could have with your older sisters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was something that was really special about my family. My dad was married before he was married to my mom, and he had two kids with his first wife, and they are 9 and 11 years older than me. You know, so technically they're my half sisters, but in my family we just have always said, you know, they're my sisters, and they would spend holidays with us, they would spend summer vacations with us, and you know, so by the time I was in elementary school, they were on their way to college soon after, and so I had these you know, cool, like, people in my life who were not my parents, who I could go to and say, oh, so all the stuff that our parents have left out about sex, like, can you please tell me? And they would, you know, they would tell me things about, you know, particularly they were women. So they would talk about, you know, how to pay attention to who you felt safe around as a really key thing to think about when it came to, sex and intimacy. You know, they talked about, you know, drugs. They talked about also like cool music. So I had that like leg up as a, you know, 10-year-old where I was much more wise to the ways of the world than my fellow fourth graders, I think, thanks to my older sisters.
I can see you there listening to the Velvet Underground or the Smiths or something in your grade four playground. Was there any information they gave you that you realized in later life was a misdirection? Were there any bum steers from those cool older sisters?
Oh, it's kind of, that's an interesting question. I remember one thing, you know, the thing when you're a little sister to older sisters who you just idolize is like, you do not question their advice. And then I realized, you know, as an adult, like, they were 20 years old. They knew nothing, you know. But one thing I can really remember, and I'm not sure if I disagree with this or not, but I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I remember when we had talked about sex, you know, the conversation was, or their advice was, you know, it's not that important that you're in love the first time you have sex, but it is really important to pay attention to whether you feel ready. And I think that was at once like really good advice, because it was like, you don't have to do anything for somebody else to make sure that they keep loving you if you love them. You know, that wasn't something I needed to do. I needed to think about if I wanted to be participating in sex. But also like, huh, that's interesting. Like, didn't have a real focus on the way that being intimate physically can deepen a connection with somebody, someone you love. Like, that wasn't the advice. So I think it was good advice, but I think it was incomplete advice.
You're from West Virginia, Anna. What kind of place was that to grow up?
So West Virginia is, a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about West Virginia. They either think of like a certain kind of white Southern poverty in the mountains, you know, Appalachian poverty. They think of coal mining, or they don't think of it at all, because it's kind of a place that's not remarkable to people who kind of grow up in big cities on the coasts in the U.S. And so I would travel as a young person and have to remind people that yes, West Virginia was its own state. It wasn't just part of Virginia. And so what that meant for what it was like to grow up there is, you know, we all had quite a big chip on our shoulder about, we felt as West Virginians that, people either looked down on us or thought we were irrelevant. And, that makes you protective of your place and your home, and sort of lock arms with people that you don't really agree with about much else about, but you are West Virginians together. And so it was a place where, you know, everybody cheered for the college football team, the West Virginia University college football team, because that was a way to get like some measure of national recognition and respect if our football team was winning, for example.
Did it win? Was it a successful team?
Oh, it won sometimes, and then it just broke your heart. The thing is, is. That's like a pretty risky thing to put all your hopes and dreams and identity around the whether a football team is going to get more points than the other team. But we, you know, we loved them. And I think that what growing up in West Virginia really made me aware of once I left was like, oh, like I understand, you know, I have been a journalist in big cities in the U.S. and in New York and in the San Francisco Bay Area now. And, you know, for people who've not spent a lot of time in rural parts of the country or less resourced parts of the country, there can be a certain, snobbery, about what those places are like. And I recoil to that. I think it's really shaped my journalism that I want to seek out people who I feel like are not being heard from enough. And, you know, a real sense of like looking out for the underdog. But let me say, you know, again, I was the daughter of a doctor. I went to a very fancy university. I was not a poor kid who grew up in rural West Virginia. You know, I am a West Virginian, but I don't have that stereotypical experience. So it's sort of this strange thing that I've carried with me of like, I really do feel like being West Virginian very much shaped my identity. But I can pass in any elite environment in the U.S. and choose when to reveal that I am not just from the suburbs of some big city, that I'm from a place that you might accidentally insult if you don't realize where I'm from.
That's interesting that you use that term pass, because listening to you, you know, one of the distinctive things for American voices to Australians is what a range of accents, which isn't really the same here in Australia. You can't tell someone from what part of the country by the way they speak. You might have a sense of their education or if they're in a city or the country, but not the area. So do other West Virginians sound like you, Anna, or is the voice something that's changed in the years you've been away from the place you grew up?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had more of an accent when I was growing up there and when I was starting in radio in West Virginia, just sort of a la, like that kind of sort of, does that make, can you hear that accent? Maybe you can't even hear what I'm trying to indicate. But I listened back to old radio tapes and I can hear that I sound more West Virginian. And, you know, it was never a conscious thing of like, oh, I need to shed this, accent to blend in, but it just happened. And I do notice that when I go home, and especially if I go home and have a few beers, like it comes back out.
Start cheering that football team.
Exactly.
You made a really gorgeous episode for your podcast, Death, Sex and Money, about your love story with Arthur. Who's Alan Simpson and what role did he play in you and Arthur getting together?
So Alan Simpson is such a strange character in American politics. He was one of the senators from the state of Wyoming, which is where Yellowstone National Park is, in part kind of also a very rural, small population state in the U.S. And he's this like, you know, if you ever hear Alan Simpson speak, you will remember that you have heard Alan Simpson speak. One example is during, I think it was after Donald Trump may have been elected. He's a Republican, so he's from the same party as Donald Trump. But he said something like, you know, if you gave Donald Trump an enema, he would fit in a shoebox, which means he's full of excrement. So he says things like this to very colorful metaphors, you know. I knew of him because I had covered him as a politics reporter, but I did not know him personally. And one thing led to another. My now husband Arthur, he studied wildlife in Wyoming, so he spent a lot of time out here following around elk and wolves. And we got to this time in our courtship after being together for 2 years when I was living in New York and he was finishing his studies, his graduate work, and spending a lot of time in the field in Wyoming. We just got to this impasse where it stopped feeling like it was clear how we were going to have a future together. If I was a working reporter in New York City and he was working on large mammals, it didn't really make sense. So we broke up and it was very sad. It was a mutual decision. And then Arthur realized that he thought we had made a mistake. And I said to him, you know, Arthur, I think let's just, this has been hard for a while. I think we've been not ready to face it, but I think this is the right decision. So I kind of put him off. And Arthur wanted to sort of figure out how to shift that conversation. And so he decided to write a letter to Alan Simpson, who was by this time a retired politician.
Now, I'm just going to stop you there, Anna. Is that in keeping with Arthur's general approach to solving personal problems?
No.
Does he fire off letters to local senators? Why on earth did he turn to his Republican senator for relationship assistance?
No, it's bonkers. And he later said, when I said, like, why was that the thing? And he said, you know, it had been so heavy and so hard. And I just thought, oh my gosh, if I pull this off, it'll make Anna laugh. It'll like shift the dynamic, which I think was so wise. But also, it was totally nuts that he did this. He wrote this letter and he said, here's the deal. You don't know me. You don't know my girlfriend, Anna. Here's our history. Please, will you give her a call on my behalf? And Alan Simpson did. So weird. Super weird. I get a phone call on my cell phone when I'm working in Manhattan from this guy in Wyoming who wants to talk about my love life.
Who is not a just any politician. Guy. I guess an elderly Republican senator.
Yes. So weird.
What did the letter actually say?
Yeah, it was like, here's what's going on. I've made a mistake. I spent too much. It was sort of like kind of lighthearted. I've spent too much time in the Wyoming wilderness. And I feel like I don't want to lose this woman. And will you, she's a politics reporter. She knows who you are. This is kind of a weird request, I realize, but would you give her a call on my behalf? Like super weird. So
much more exciting than flowers or you know, a chocolate sent in the mail.
Yeah, inventive and just really like vulnerable and bold. You know, he asked for help. He asked for help, you know, which is really telling about Arthur's character. He's a very strong, sturdy man, but he asks for help when he needs it, which is a really important quality. But the thing that is like such a delight about this, and Arthur had no way of knowing, like Alan Simpson isn't just like a colorful talker. He's also a man who's been married for more than 60 years to an incredible woman named Ann Simpson. And when he called me, I could hear this woman like kind of like talking in the background. Like they're one of those couples that they like make joint phone calls, you know, and she was like, you know, just kind of commenting on all the things that he was saying about what a wild letter it was to get. And I heard her and I said, well, Al, like, well, what does Anne think I should do? And he's like, well, let me put her on. So then I'm talking to Alan Simpson's wife, Anne, and she was incredible because she just got on the phone and she said, look, like, we don't know you. But I can tell you that every relationship is hard. Alan and I have had our own troubles. We've had couples counseling. It was hard for us when he was in Washington and I had to be back in Wyoming where our families are. Like, it was not easy. I don't know what you should do, but I can tell you to not let your pride get in the way. And it was just such a astute analysis of what was going on. And so I called up Arthur and I said, like, you'll never believe who called me, because he just sent off this letter. He didn't know it was going to work. And I just want to be clear, like, it was a novelty to get this phone call. But what it did was it reopened Arthur and I talking, and it did give us something to laugh about. And it kind of like shifted things for me into this sense of like, maybe I don't have to feel like I can see 30 years ahead to know that, like, this relationship is worth spending time in, you know. Maybe I can look at this partner and say, like, maybe we can just figure it out as we go along. And the reason I was so terrified about making that leap is I had a marriage fail. I was divorced and I was in my early 30s and I was really wanted to be a parent. And so I felt time pressure to not waste time. So it was this pressure cooker of just like, don't screw it up, Anna. And so I was like, anything that made me feel nervous or scared felt like a red flag. And this encounter with the Simpsons kind of helped me move through that to trust a little bit that you don't have to have everything figured out before you say, let's try.
One of the things that had been a stressor in your first marriage was money. How did money become a difficult conversation, a difficult subject in that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think looking back at myself, I can remember being like, oh, we can sit down and we can talk about how much money we're going to spend on a vacation or how much money we can afford in rent. And we could like make a budget together, my ex-husband and I. So I kind of felt like, oh, we're doing okay. We're talking about money. But I think what we were not good at talking about was money in a much larger sense, which was like, how do each of us feel about risk? What kind of stability do we want to feel like we're building within our family with one another? What kind of adventures do we want to have? And it turned out we have really fundamentally different kind of personalities and dispositions when it came to that. What revealed that was we had been married a few years, and my ex, who had been a civil rights attorney, sort of said, like, I've realized I don't want to be an attorney for the rest of my life. I love movies and I want to go to film school. And this was right as the economic crisis was really taking off in the U.S. And, you know, I was a public radio journalist, so I'm not a high earning person who could comfortably think of myself as a breadwinner in a couple. And then he got into NYU film school, which is not an inexpensive place. New York City is not an inexpensive place. But then he got a tuition fellowship he wasn't going to have to pay. And it was like one of those moments where I was like, this is your husband, Anna. This is his dream. I know, you know, I was very aware of how uncomfortable it made me feel, the prospect of quitting my job, moving to New York, trying to find work in the middle of a recession as he started film school. But I just thought, you don't say no to this. Like, you can't. So I sort of knuckled through that anxiety, and it ended up being okay. Like, it was a scary time, hard to find journalism work, but I found work. We found a cheap apartment, and the money stuff wasn't causing our difficulties, but it was sort of revealing it. And what ultimately was revealed was, you know, there was a moment where we were arguing on a little plane on our way home to West Virginia. We were both from West Virginia. And he just kind of said, like, Anna, you want to have a house and a family and live in a, you know, live the same place. And like, I don't want that. I want to make movies all over the world. I don't want to like settle down. And it was felt like such a, it was a terrifying moment because it was like so true. Like, what we wanted was not the same. And so when we were arguing around the fringes of our money conversations, what we were really talking about was like, what do we want our lives to look like? So I think it was powered by money, but money in the largest sense about, you know, how you think about what you want your life to look like and how you're going to pay for it and what you're willing to do to make that happen.
It's such an interesting topic, money, isn't it? Because it is on the surface of often really deep values or dreams or fears, but it's also something we don't talk about well.
I have become obsessed with it. I will tell you, going through a divorce where part of, you know, fighting about money is part of what is the end of a marriage, and then all of a sudden being a single divorced person trying to make it work in New York City, it really makes you very obsessed with the question of like, wait, how is everybody else doing this? And why is nobody talking about it? Because life costs money, you know, like there's no getting around having to spend money. And I think that sort of powered was one of the primary motivators for the start of Death, Sex, and Money, the podcast, because I just felt like, oh my gosh, there's so many rich stories that we're leaving on the table because people are afraid to ask. And the way that I think about asking about money is not just saying like, so how much money is in your checking account right now? Like that's not necessarily what I'm talking about. It's more like the idea of including the financial sort of dimensions and dynamics that were at play as part of your sort of life plot. You know, I just find that so much more interesting. It helps you understand when people feel really desperate or when people feel unafraid, if they have like a little bit of a cushion that they feel like they can take more risks. Like when you look at someone and you're like, wait, how on earth did they get the nerve to do that? And then you're like, oh, multi-generational wealth. Like, now I understand, you know? And I think that so much of why we don't talk about it is because, like, oh, there's just shame at every corner, every turn. Like, if you are someone who has multi-generational wealth, you don't really want to, like, talk about that because you feel like it somehow suggests that everything you have done hasn't been as a result of your own actions. It makes anything you've accomplished called into question. And, you know, and I don't think that has to be the case. Like, it could be, you know, someone could say, you know what, when I was getting out of grad school, like was the case for my husband, when he was getting out of grad school, he had a couple of $20,000 or so from his grandmother that he had inherited, and that enabled him to not immediately feel totally freaked. Whereas if he did not have that, it would have been a really different story about how he would have to think about what the next phase was going to be after he finished grad school. Like, and there's not, it doesn't have to be a bad thing to say that. It's like, here was my situation. You know, for me, my college was paid for by my parents. And so I got to think about public radio journalism as something that was an option for me. I didn't have to think about massive student loan payments like so many young people in the U.S. I didn't have to have that as part of my budget. And that was a real gift for me in terms of my options.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Anna, when we talk about money, we tend to focus on the things that we feel we have control over as individuals, like, you know, should you have spent that money on a holiday or how much are you borrowing from the bank? But there are much bigger systems in play when it comes to money, and they can be harder to name, harder to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's like something that is a very obvious thing that I point out in the book. And I remember writing the sentences like, haven't people realized this before, but I'm just going to say it, which is, you know, it is not an either or situation. We, you know, so often when we talk about money, we are talking about systems and structures. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you talk about personal choices and hard work versus not hard work, or that, you know, that's the way our politics and the political debates, particularly in the U.S., get framed. And I just, you know, it's like both and, like, we are all participating in systems and structures, and we also are making personal choices based on the options available to us. And so, you know, I can both be really proud of some of the results of the work that I've done and also recognize, oh, here's the luck that I had in graduating in the year that I did, and that I was able to find a journalism job, and there weren't just no jobs available. I was able to get a foothold in an industry that I've come to really love. Like, both and, that's okay.
You've been hosting Death, Sex and Money for 7 years, I think. What have you discovered about the best way to raise some of these tough subjects with strangers?
Well, I think I think it's both with strangers and with people in your life. Like, when you know that you are feeling like you want to ask about or have a conversation about something that is, you know, outside the pitter-patter of regular sort of catching up and chit-chat, when you know you might, you know, come up against some tender places, it really can do a lot to just sort of acknowledge that at the outset and explain why you want to have that conversation. And I do this a lot with people that I'm interviewing on the show. I just, you know, and I'm helped by the name of the show. You know, when you have a podcast named Death, Sex, and Money, it's sort of like there's a big elephant in the room, you know. And I will say something like, you know, I might I'm going to ask about personal moments in your life, but I want to explain why. I'm not doing it to be, you know, sort of gratuitous or you know, just prying. Like, part of the spirit of our show is that these times of transition and difficulty are when you feel the most isolation, and so it can be a real help to hear others talking about it. So that's why I'm asking, because I think it could be helpful to people who are listening. And when you describe that kind of like larger mission, what's so cool is I can feel it and observe it and how I'm talking to people. They sort of lean in and they kind of become co-creators of this conversation where they are perhaps revealing more than they would have otherwise, but they're with the intention of like, I will share this, because they're now picturing somebody who might have gone through something difficult. You know, they might be picturing the person who also had to, you know, go to an abortion clinic as a young woman all by herself and face that decision all alone. They might be thinking about the person who lost a parent and has trying decades later to still understand how grief operates and comes in waves, you know? So I just think, again, just like, why do you want to have the conversation? So people don't feel ambushed or like they need to like feel like they're going to be interrogated, but explain the intention of why. And then the other thing I say in interviews is, you know, and of course, if I ask about anything that you don't want to talk about, you know, just tell me and I'll move on.
And maybe it's a relief for people to talk to a stranger, as well as it might be easier to ask those questions of a stranger sometimes. Perhaps it's easier to disclose distressing things or shameful secrets to someone who you're not going to see at breakfast the next day.
Totally. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a reason that, you know, we tell our secrets to bartenders and podcast hosts. You know, it's easier.
You interview on the program both famous people who are really familiar with being interviewed and everyday people who aren't. Do you have to use different techniques? You know, are one of those groups more hesitant to share than the other?
You know, sort of. I think, you know, the main thing I think about with people who are really well known is, when you've been interviewed a lot, you sort of go into these ruts with how you tell stories and what you share and how you describe things. And so I'm always looking for the like question that's like, wait, what? Tell me a little bit more about that, you know, so that they go more into like, oh, you're actually listening to this story. I'll tell you a little bit more. You know, so it's indicating that you're really actually listening to them as a person and not just like trying to get whatever, some quote for a boldface name that they're going to read on an airplane on a tabloid, you know, 2 weeks later and be like, where did that come from? Oh, her, you know. And then with people who aren't as comfortable being interviewed, I think it's what I think is so interesting is, what an unusual experience it is for most of us to have someone listen and ask us questions about our life, you know, for more than 30 minutes at a time. Like, that is who's not our therapist.
We're not paying. Listening, that quality of listening, I think that is something you learn as an interviewer that can be much harder to do in our own lives. Just shutting up and letting the other person speak. How important is that in having a conversation about a hard subject?
I think it's really important, and I also understand how difficult it can be. But I can feel the different modes. It feels different in my body. You know, when I'm having a difficult conversation with my husband Arthur, for example, and something he's saying makes me feel frustrated or, you know, unfairly maligned, or, you know, we're having a disagreement about something, you know, I very quickly, I'll just go into battle mode. You know, I can feel myself get defensive. I can feel myself get frustrated. And I have to really tell myself, like, Anna, like, slow down and try to understand what he is trying to communicate to you. Like, what is the source of the hurt? And I almost have to coach myself, like, you don't want him to be hurting as much as you want to be right, you know? And usually, and then I will finally get to the place of even more than you want to be right, you don't want him to be hurting. So I think that can really just sort of like lower the pace, lower the temperature, and allow me to get back into a zone of like, okay, well, can you explain to me again, like, why was that so frustrating to you? I thought I was just, you know, doing whatever, you know. These are very common arguments in our life because we have two little kids and have been working all in the same space. So we've been having a lot of these kinds of arguments.
Ample opportunity to return to these conversations.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when you describe it, then it's like you're also having the hard conversation with yourself when you say that you're having to coach yourself or remind yourself. Like, we're putting it into words with the person in the room, but also with our own better nature or our own psyche.
Absolutely. And I think that is like such a big part of hard conversations, is really trying to be clear as much as you can ahead of time and then in the moment. Like, what is the larger objective of this conversation? You know, is it to understand? Is it to learn something? To reveal something we disagree about and just have that out there? You see it this way, I see it this way, we disagree. Okay. I think that is so, so very important, and also really, really hard to do. But it's about, you know, it's training that muscle of self-awareness, while you also are tending to the person that you are in relationship with and having this hard conversation with, you know? And so I think that often, when we think about, oh, I don't want to have that hard conversation because I don't know what to say about that thing that, you know, whether it's a money disagreement or someone is in deep grief and you don't know what to say to comfort them, we often sort of think, oh, I don't know the words to say that are going to make this feel resolvable. And I think that's often the wrong approach. It's so much about, yes, there's the content of what you're going to describe, but you have a lot of choices about how you tend to the relationship and think about your own self-awareness in a conversation, that's really the more important thing about whether it's a successful hard conversation.
There have been a number of times when I've spoken to people who've had a really tragic loss, you know, whether a stillbirth or lost a family member to suicide or some other real trauma. And often they'll say that there were many people in their life who found that so distressing or were so unsure about how to approach it that they'd avoid the person in grief. I remember one woman saying that in her hometown, after she'd lost her dad and her sister to suicide, people would cross the street to avoid her because they didn't know what to say and how painful that was, especially around grief. That anxiety about the right words can stop us offering any comfort or any support.
Yeah. I mean, and then I think there's the avoidance, and then there's also that strange dynamic that can happen where if someone is trying to be helpful, if you're in deep grief and you can feel their effort, then you as the grieving person feels this obligation to sort of perform like you're doing okay so that they feel like they are in fact being helpful, which is like a lot of energy on top of deep grief. And we're doing this because it's so simple, but it's so hard. Like, if someone is in deep grief, if someone has lost a child to suicide or someone to suicide in their life, what you can say is, I'm so sorry. I've been thinking about you. I'm so sorry. And then you can, you know, a year later, you see them, you run into them. How are you doing? Oh, I was thinking about your son. I was remembering this thing. Like, acknowledge that person who was lost, that they did exist. Like, how loving that can be, instead of just avoiding it because you're afraid that mentioning their death is somehow gonna upset everything. And often, you know, what you hear from grieving people is like, I have not forgotten.
This is something you're not going to remind me of something.
With me.
And there's that other phrase that can be a go-to, but perhaps isn't really a useful one, which is, let me know if you need anything. What's the problem with that phrase?
Yeah, and I hadn't really thought of this, but I interview a woman named Megan Devine in my book, who's a grief counselor who also had a profound loss. She lost her partner in a sudden drowning accident. And she said, like, just think about that, what the impact of that statement is. Yes, it's saying, I want to be there for you. That's what's embedded in that, which is loving. But it's also saying to the grieving person, think about what you need. Think about all the list of things. Then think about who in your life is the person to call and ask them to do that. And then call them and say, I actually don't have any plans for dinner on Thursday night. Can you bring by a casserole? Instead of just bringing by the casserole, you know, or being more proactive, saying something like, oh, I know you've got your kids at home. Like, I'm going to take them out to the playground on Tuesdays and Thursdays for the next 3 weeks, just so you have some time by yourself. You know, that is such a different statement than saying, let me know if you need anything.
Exactly. It's taking that burden of decision making, which can often be the impossible thing for someone who's just trying to cope moment to moment. One of the hard subjects that I think, or, you know, I hope that we're trying to have is new conversations around race. And as a white woman, Anna, I wondered what conversations about race and identity you find the hardest.
Oh, I find them hard all the time. Because I find them hard, but they're getting easier. Let me say that. I have found them really hard when I started out in journalism, because I just recognized, like, I don't have a lot of practice with this. I don't have a lot of practice, like, with saying, like, you know, I'm a white woman, so this was my experience, like, but I realize you're black. What was your experience? Like, naming race is just not something I grew up knowing how to do and learning how to do and having that modeled for me. And so I feel, now, like, I'm like, how do I both acknowledge that there's difference, and that those differences are profound. Those differences affect the ways that I move through space and that others move through space, and how, not just how they are identified by other people, but how they identify. So there's layers to this, and it's not just one thing that you're talking about. And then I want to talk about it. And then I also don't want to, like, go overboard and be like, trying to demonstrate, like, what a well-versed white person I am. You know what I mean? There's, like, really a way to overdo it, particularly as a white person, where you can, like, show, like, well, as I was reading in my anti-racist book of the week. So I just find it's like, it, you know, the thing that I, the place that I just kind of fall back into is, like, I'm going to do my best. I'm going to acknowledge when I feel clumsy in my own self. And I also am going to make mistakes. And when I have it pointed out to me, or I recognize that I have made mistakes, I'm going to acknowledge it and apologize, and just do the best I can. And I think that's, you know, not comfortable. Particularly, there's a woman I interview in the book, Peggy McIntosh, who's a scholar of privilege, and in particular about the privilege that white people have, and one of the major, you know, aspects of that is, as a white person in the United States, we are sort of raised to believe that we are the knowers, and we are the ones, we are the holders of sort of, like, what is the way to do things, and everything else is other, and to instead try to inhabit a space of not knowing and of trying, but knowing you might mess up, and not being able to just come up with a to-do list that's going to make sure that you prevent messing up. That's very uncomfortable for white people. It's very uncomfortable for me, but I just try to linger in that space of, like, okay, this is what it is to move through the world and recognize that other people move through the world differently. I want to notice what I can. I want to learn what I can and allow for those spaces of difference to exist and for that to be a motor of my curiosity and also my humility.
Another a point that the researcher Peggy McIntosh makes is that we could hide behind being a nice white person, that if individually we're nice, then that's sort of all that we need to be able to do. And similarly to the money conversation, it's both personal and systems. There are layers in history that our niceness doesn't let us escape from. Again, though, they're the harder harder elements to acknowledge when you're face to face with another individual. I mean, how do you keep straddling both the way you might personally be in the world and the reality that as a white person you come out of a whole world of privilege that's automatically different from people of color?
I think for Peggy McIntosh to say, like, this isn't about whether you're nice. I can't smile and be charming and be curious to any person who is not white that I might come across in an interview or in my life, and indicate that I'm a good white person and that they're going to like me and think that I'm on the side of right and justice. Like, whether I'm nice has nothing to do with, like, how I'm read by them. You know, they might be bringing a lot of other histories to our encounter. And it's not about me. It's not about just me, which is important for white people to realize. And it's not just about my comfort. So I think that, like, I can say I am doing my best in every interpersonal interaction I have. Also, I am a part of systems of oppression that privilege me. And that, like, I benefit from, and I need to keep my eyes open and be aware of that, and also try to do what I can to make those systems work for people who don't look like me.
We use that lovely phrase, a motor of curiosity. It's the curiosity that we bring to some of these conversations and the willingness to be in discomfort as we hear another person's experience. There's parallels I find in conversations I've had with some men in the wake of Me Too, you know, even with friends, with colleagues, with family. It's been interesting how rarely I've been asked about my experience and how often men have told me their opinion about Me Too. Have you found that?
I mean, certainly, let's see. I mean, I think I've had both experiences. Like, I do feel like there were a lot of men in my life who were just shocked at the volume and the number of people in their lives who have felt harmed by men, whether from physical assault or from harassment or any number of ways of feeling undermined and disrespected. And so I did have a lot of conversations about that with men in my life and men that I work with. And also some of those, like, come on, you know, like, come on, buck up. And I don't know, I think those conversations are really interesting. And it's about what the kind of role I try to play in those conversations is to say, like, huh, like, what's this about? You know, and sometimes you discover, like, men in my life who have also been assaulted by men, and you discover what their coping mechanisms have been like. And those are difficult conversations that I could have missed if I hadn't said, like, why do you have this, like, coarseness about this? Like, this is hard. It's, you know, and for, like, a man to say to me, well, this is how I got through it when I was attacked, you know? So I think we don't know. So, but just to try to be like, huh, that's interesting that that's your response. Well, here's the way I think about it. Like, and try to have that sort of comparing notes, sort of conversation. I've learned a lot in those.
Yeah, and I guess from the way you're describing it, we can each shift the conversation we're in. If someone's on one kind of track or maybe not bringing a curiosity, we can point that out or help shift it to a different track.
Yeah, you know, and I try to do it in a way that's not like that keeps the sort of channel of communication open. You know, I get the impulse to be like, why are you like pretending like all these women's, like, experiences don't matter. That's totally sexist and I don't want to talk to you anymore. Like, I get that impulse. But I try, well, sort of like, that's interesting. Like, why does it agitate you so much that this is happening? Like, what is this taking away? Like, what can you explain why this is frustrating to you? And kind of get at that and, like, kind of place their emotional reaction back on them, and see how they explain it.
These conversations can do a lot, but they don't always lead to more intimacy or to better feelings. Like, hard conversations can end in hard places. talking has its limits too, doesn't it?
It really does. And I think that, like, having a hard conversation with really good intentions and a spirit of listening and understanding does not mean you are going to get to a resolution. It doesn't guarantee that. And it doesn't have to, you know. One of the big things I learned by writing about the end of my first marriage in the book was, oh, like I sort of re-examined with my ex-husband. I interviewed him, like the sets of conversations we had at the end of our marriage, because I'd sort of filed it away as like, obviously we did something wrong because our marriage ended. We failed at something. We didn't get married with the intention of getting divorced. So we must have not done something right together. And now I see it in a much different way. I see that we did dig in together and we had a lot of conflict and we asked for a lot of help and went to couples counseling and read books together. And it was really painful to realize that our hard conversations were actually revealing that we wanted different things. So in hindsight now, I see those hard conversations as being done right. It made us see more clearly, and both of us are, you know, our lives have unfolded in really wonderful ways. At the time, I felt like failure and like I was doing something wrong because I wasn't able to fix it through hard conversations. And that's not what hard conversations guarantee. What they do help you do is move out of a space of pretending or haziness or dishonesty and help you see more clearly, which I think is, for me, really important. And it does help you see one another. And I think that is, even when it reveals the ways you disagree, really seeing one another is a really deep way of showing up and showing love.
Anna, this has not been a hard conversation for me. This has just been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been really great.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.